Senate State Affairs is called to order. The time is 9:04. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Present for the record, Senators Bundy, Stevens, French, and myself, McGuire. And we have five items on the agenda today. Senate Bill 227, Senate Bill 228, House Bill Number 196, House Bill 92, and House Bill 351. We're going to go ahead and take up the sponsor substitute for Senate Bill Number 198, which we had in a previous committee. And we do have the bill's sponsor here, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm State Senator for Northeast Anchorage. And at this point, I think we'll have a very brief presentation from my staff member, Michelle, on this, just to outline what the substitute does, if you like, or if not.
That would be great. Good morning, Michelle. Welcome.
Hi, for the record, my name is Michelle Seideman, and I'm staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. I believe you all in your packet have a short statement about the changes between SB 198 and the sponsor substitute, but I'll walk through them quickly. The sponsor substitute retains the core provisions of the original bill, which is an extension of the statute of limitations for the Alaska Public Offices Commission from 1 to 4 years, as well as a repeal of a current statute governing Department of Law prosecutions of campaign finance violations. So with that repeal, the Department of Law would have up to 5 years to carry on criminal prosecutions, which is a general statute of limitations for them. The following sections of the original bill were also deleted based on committee discussion when we met last. Section 1 proposed restricting post-election fundraising from 45 days to 10 days after an election. Section 3 proposed limiting the amount of surplus campaign funds that can be given to a political party to $5,000. And Section 5 proposed increasing the civil penalty for lobbyists who do not file required reports with the commission from $10 to $50 a day. So those provisions were removed to just stick with the core mission of the bill and simplify it and go with the basics.
Okay, fantastic. And questions for the sponsor's representative, Senator Bundy.
No, thank you. You mentioned up to 5 years, and that is on line 9 of the sponsor substitute. It says 4 years. So you're including the fourth year. So when you say up to 5 years, is that?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, there are actually two parts of this bill. Section 1 deals with the APOC statute of limitations, and that returns it to the four-year statute that was in effect up until 2003. Section 2 repeals AS 15.56.130, so it's line 13 of page 1 of the sponsor substitute, and that refers to criminal prosecutions of campaign finance laws. There have been very, very few of those, maybe a handful in, I think, several decades. There are certainly experts here that can speak to that. But if that one-year statute is repealed, there's a five-year, more general statute of limitations for this type of criminal violation that already exists in law. So that's to clarify.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, we do have an amendment. We'll call this amendment number 1. This is Bullard L1. And this is brought to us by Joyce Anderson with the Legislative Ethics Committee. And on page 1, line 15, it should reflect 4 years, which is consistent with the APOC bill by Senator Wilikowski, and it was Joyce's belief that we should make both the ethics statute of limitations and the APOC statute of limitations consistent, and so that's what amendment number 1 would do. So I'll move amendment number 1. Okay, and so hearing and seeing no objection, amendment number 1 carries. Is there a motion on the bill?
Could
Senator French?
Just ask a question. About the amendment we just adopted, it deletes all the material on lines 5 through 12, and that is related to APOC. This restates the APOC provisions, and then it adds the ethics provisions. Is that how it works? I see it's chapter 15 and then chapter 24, so it's both. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. That was a little faster than I was.
Yeah.
It's okay. Joyce, if you want to put yourself on the record and...
Okay, my name is Joyce Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. And basically what this amendment does is, in answer to your question, Senator French, is that on lines 19 to 21, it added the language that the time limitations of this subsection do not bar proceedings against a person who intentionally prevents discovery of a violation of this.
When you stay on lines 19 to 21, do you mean the amendment or the bill?
I'm sorry, of the amendment.
Okay. And that's pertaining to APOC.
Right. That has been added for APOC language, and it's also in the ethics statute. And so what it's doing is it's making it consistent not only with the statute of limitations for 4 years, it's making it consistent with the language that would be both in the ethics statute and then the APOC statute.
So in essence, this amendment adds to the APOC bill an ethics provision, which makes the two parallel and consistent.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Green.
And what is the reality of that? Does it mean that there's not a limitation of 4 years?
Senator Green, yes, that's correct. If there was an intentional prevention of discovery. So in other words, in some of the cases that have come out recently, there was a... you could say there was a intentional prevention of discovery of a violation, and then that would go beyond the 4 years.
Senator Green?
Senator
Stephen.
Okay, this all is lawyer speak, and so for those of us who are not and choose not to be, could you explain specifically what it means, a person who intentionally prevents discovery or violation? Could you give us some specifics? What are you talking about there?
Senator Stevens, that would be if there were some information that was obtained that the individual, possibly maybe in some of the corruption cases that have occurred, where the individual intentionally prevented discovery of some act that they did, and then that would waive the statute, the four-year statute of limitations, and then there would be no statute of limitations in that aspect, and that both APOC or the Ethics Committee could initiate a complaint. Let's just use the example of APOC right now as a one-year statute of limitations. And so they are, in regard to Jim Clark, they were unable to initiate any type of investigation. This would have allowed them to do that. Granted, we're looking at the 1 year, but if it had been the 4 year, it would have allowed them to look at that particular issue.
Senator Bundy.
Like in criminal cases, this would be a charge with tampering with evidence and, you know, shredding documents, doing something like that. Is that what when you're talking about intentionally preventing discovery?
Senator Bundy, that would have to be, if you're looking at it, it would have to be a violation, which would be under the code of either APOC or ethics. So it would actually have to be one of the areas of the conflict of interest or whatever in the ethics code, and as well as the APOC statutes, which cover campaigning, lobbying, and financial disclosures.
Sorry, I'm trying to...
Actually,
I have two questions. One, is this new? Did the one-year statute of limitation also include the language, if you intentionally prevented discovery, there would be no statute of limitations?
Senator Bundy, no, it did not.
Okay, so this is new language. Then intentionally preventing discovery, we have honest mistakes in APOC. Someone forgot to fill something out, filled it out incorrectly. They didn't know about it or knew about it and went back and corrected it. Now you're saying if they knew about it and then they falsified or destroyed evidence, then the statute of limitations wouldn't apply.
Senator Bundy, I suppose you could use that example. I would think it would be at the discretion of both APOC and the Ethics Committee to look at that to see what how egregious the offense is and so forth. I know that both you, Senator Bundy, and Senator Stevens are on the Ethics Committee. presently, and that we have looked at issues and looked at facts and so forth and made a decision. The Ethics Committee makes the decision whether they're going to initiate the complaint.
If I might, Madam Chair, so the decision as to whether there was any intentional prevention of discovery would lie with the Ethics Committee?
The way I'm reading the statute and the way it has been interpreted by the present Ethics Committee, yes.
And with the present Ethics Committee, I have no question about their abilities, but I might have questions about some others. Why are you asking for this?
Senator Bundy, currently it's in the ethics statute itself, and it has been in there for years. And so to make it consistent between ethics and APOC, when this bill was heard in House Judiciary as well as in House State Affairs, it was decided to include that in the ethics statute, excuse me, in the APOC statute. Right. And so that's why when I had talked to Senator McGuire's office, I included that in here because that's what had happened in the House Judiciary and House State Affairs Committee.
Yeah. And so that I understand, if I might, Madam Chair, this is existing law in the ethics law.
That's correct.
And now it would become existing law in the APOC arena, but the Ethics Committee would still make the decision as to whether there had been intentional prevention of discovery, or is APOC going to make that decision?
Senator Bundy, APOC would make that under their jurisdiction.
So they become judge, jury, and executioner.
And we'll go forward with the debate. We did adopt, there was no objection to it, but if we wanted, we can continue the debate, and I won't rule it out of order. We'll just continue to discuss it. But if we did want to take any concrete action to make any changes, then we'd just have to rescind our action. So,
Senator, we rescind our action.
Okay, so Senator Green makes a motion that we rescind our action adopting amendment number one for the purposes of allowing us to reconsider the debate. Is there an objection to rescinding our action? Senator French.
I'll object, and we can have the debate either on the bill itself or on either
yeah.
portion.
Yeah.
And I think we can debate it within the context of the rescinding motion. So I think we need to debate it more. I totally agree with you on that. But I'm not opposed to the substance. It just happened a little too quickly, I think.
And I'd just like to rescind our action, start over, and then
do it again.
For us again, yeah.
Fair enough. Then, okay. Then I'll withdraw my.
And I feel comfortable as the chair. You know how that happens. Sometimes you get a little bit further out ahead because you have a heads up. So is there an objection to rescinding our action on amendment number one? Okay, hearing and seeing none. Then we have amendment number one before us, and I will go ahead and move the amendment.
And I'll object.
And there's an objection noted, and now we'll continue discussion on amendment number one, and we are at Senator Green and then going to Senator French.
Okay. Well, if I'd known this was in the ethics provisions, I would have complained about it then, too. Because it looks like to me that there is, in essence, no time limit. And how do you... After the 4 years, how do you have the right to go back and even look at it?
Senator Green, through the chair, I guess it would be because it's in statute, so it would.
Senator
Green.
On this one, then, just because this isn't in statute. Okay, how do you have the ability to go back and look if you have a 4 year? Time limit. How do you, after that time, have the ability to go back and look and determine if something's wrong? To me, it's off the table. Am I wrong?
Can I jump in?
Yes, Senator Fritz.
I think I can just offer you an example. It might help make bring it to life. Say someone came to, in this case, it's APOC because it is already in the ethics statute. So someone comes to APOC tomorrow with. A tape recording, and says this tape recording is from a 1980 election, and it shows a videotape of a candidate and his campaign manager shredding the checks that they received in a campaign after a campaign event, and it shows them changing the names and changing the amounts and changing and doing all this horrible activity to subvert the, you know, rules that surround a campaign reporting requirements. That would be a complaint, and they would bring this as a complaint to the APOC Commission, saying, you need to look into this. Look, there's drop-dead evidence of this horrible act that took place, you know, 30 years ago. APOC might say, well, that's beyond the 4 years. Sorry, you know, they got away with it. Or they might say, if this were on the books, they could say, well, gee, you know, it looks like it's not barred because they are intentionally preventing discovery of a violation of the chapter. So that's kind of how it would play out. Someone would come to APOC with a complaint, say, this is outside the normal statute of limitations. I got drop-dead evidence that they were intentionally preventing the discovery of a violation. And so APOC would go, you know, yes or no, is that intentionally preventing the discovery of the violation? If they decide yes, then they would say this is a valid complaint and proceed. If they decide no, that wasn't intentionally preventing a violation, it would be more like Senator Bundy's example, where it just looks like they didn't fill out their forms right. And I know I'm guilty of not having filled out one of my forms right. You know, I mean, we all try to fill out our forms right, but, you know, you make a mistake. And so if they decide it was not an intentional violation, they'd say, sorry, it's outside the 4 years. We're done. Case closed. We're not going to go, you know, harass an honest candidate for their misstatements or mistakes. Does that make it clear?
No, it's still not in Senator Green. Senator Bundy had his
Senator Bundy.
Well, and I don't want to, I'm on a slightly different tack. I don't want to interrupt. Preface my remarks. APOC has been incredibly helpful to me, and I have great confidence in current people in that office. They do a good job. I see some differences here, having served on the Ethics Committee previously and now. You do get a group of five people discussing the possibility of an ethics violation and intentionally preventing discovery of a violation. And the ethics areas seems to me more of a gray area that would require this group discussion. But now we're going to APOC and some future APOC, not current people. And who makes that decision? One person? The director of APOC saying, I think this was an intentional prevention of discovery, and essentially there's no statute of limitations. Under criminal law, there are very few offenses that have no statute of limitations, and that seems like I'm not much of a record keeper, and I look forward to the day that I clean out all those records and have a bonfire.
And get your shredder.
Yeah, well, I'm not the high tech, just a bonfire. But now we're saying that when you're long retired from office, you really better hang on to your campaign APOC report records, because there's no statute of limitations. And I don't want to go back and reopen the ethics one. But like I say, I think it's a little different, where you got five people basically being the jury on whether that's an ethics violation or not, and whether there'd be intentional prevention of discovery, versus one person sometime in the future making that decision. So I understand the goal for common laws, but I see two vastly different kinds of organizations. I'm wondering if we want to say there are, in effect, no statute of limitations. And who knows, the number of people that I've upset in 10 years from now would say, I'm going to be a nuisance.
Right. Is there an amendment to the amendment? Does anybody have an amendment to the amendment? Do the objections maintained against the amendment itself? Senator Green, discussion?
I'm in trying to look at the original bill and comparing it to the language in the current Section 1, I mean, it's vastly different from the sponsor substitute, because we're into a whole new, I'm sorry, there's just not been enough discussion on this, and I'm not ready to have an amendment, nor am I ready to vote for or against this amendment. I think there's some implications here that I'm not at all comfortable with, and don't necessarily want APOC to be able to go back for...
Where does the bill go next?
Judiciary, I think.
Judiciary, okay. Why don't we go ahead and do this? Joyce, why don't I go ahead and withdraw the amendment and allow you time to get with the members, let them look it over, discuss it, think about it, synthesize the parts of it, and it goes to Judiciary next. Senator French's committee, I'm on it. And so we don't have a moment here where folks aren't prepared. This is a bill that we had heard Joyce earlier and had much deliberation on. So why don't we go ahead and set it aside? It'll come back before us in Judiciary. It has Judiciary.
It does. We have to move it out, though.
Yes. So we're back now with the original Senate Bill 198 before us. Is there a motion, please? Senator French.
That Senate Bill 198 be moved out of this committee onto the next committee referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Okay, is there an objection to moving Senate Bill 198 with individual recommendations, CS for Senate Bill 198 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes?
Well, I object just for...
There's an objection, Senator
just
Stevens.
Just for discussion. I want to hear from the proposer what this does again, briefly.
Thank you, Joyce. Senator Wilikowski?
What we're talking about is what now? What is the bill in front of us? Is it the L version?
It's the L version. So we're down to the basic four-year statute of limitation as opposed to one on APOC complaints, correct?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Stevens through the chair. Just for clarification, the bill goes to finance next, actually.
I beg your pardon. It had been referred to Judiciary, but on the sponsor substitute. Right. I beg your pardon.
Okay.
And all the core bill does, backslash L, is it extends the APOC statute of limitations for from 1 year to 4 years, and it the criminal statute of limitations goes to 4 years as well. 5 years, I'm sorry. That's all the base bill does. I hadn't seen this amendment until you saw it, just for the record.
Senator Stevens and then Senator Green.
Okay, I appreciate that, Senator. So what this is now is very similar to the one we've already passed to finance by Senator Terrio. Is that true?
Actually, this goes a little bit further in that this repeals, this extends the criminal statute of limitations to 5 years.
Senator Green.
Is there something, where does it say 5 years? Is that reference to another statute? Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
The repeal of Section 2 makes it a 5-year statute of limitation for criminal.
That's deleted. The criminal prosecution is deleted, right?
Yes.
Okay. It goes to a default 5 years if you take that out.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so is everyone clear now then with L? And we technically had the motion, and it carried, and we passed it out. So I'm going to move a little slower this morning so that we get the discussion at the appropriate points. Okay, and so we, in fact, have moved out the sponsor substitute for Senate Bill number 198 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Okay. Thank you, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you.
And just for the record, my error was not intentional.
We can give it a judiciary referral if you'd like that.
I'll defer to the sponsor.
Thank you.
I'll defer to the sponsor. Okay, and so Joyce Anderson, you will get around to the members. Okay. Not that you don't have other things to do. All right. We are next going to go to, I had been asked if I would, Shalon, let me take a brief at ease. We are back in order and on the record, and we are going to move down the state affairs calendar to bring up the matter of House Bill number 92, Jurisdiction of Ombudsman and Victim Rights, and we do have the bill sponsors here. Representative Samuels and Representative Stoltz. Tell us about the bill, please.
Thank you, Chair McGuire. Representative Samuels and I are the co-prime sponsors on this, and we've both had multi-years involvement with the Office of Victims' Rights, actually even before it, the bill was passed into law and developing it. He is a citizen advocate, and myself as a staff member. Senator Halford drafted the legislation, it was modeled modeled after the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman's Office as a similar stand beside organization. The director of that organization is selected through a bipartisan process, and it's a pretty bipartisan vote because it's a supermajority vote, so it's a consensus position. So that much like the Ombudsman, last year or just before last year, there were some jurisdictional skirmishes between the Ombudsman's Office and the Office of Victims' Rights. As being in on the birthing of this, we were very familiar with the intent that it was a organization that had jurisdiction granted by the legislature as a legislative branch agency. And this legislation we have before us is to clarify the intent to avoid litigation between one branch of the legislature and another. And there's certainly a lot of reasons why they're separate, and I think Representative Samuels can articulate some of those, and I'll jump in if anything gets left out. And I'm Bill Stoltz from Chugiak, Wasilla, for the record.
Thank you. This is Ralph Samuels from District 29 in South Anchorage. I concur with everything that Representative Stoltz said as far as the creation goes. The OVR was created as an ombudsman, but a specialized ombudsman for the victims of crime only. And when these skirmishes have taken place, you could easily see an inherent conflict. If you put one of these over the other, and I don't think it's appropriate to have OVR all ruling either, is almost half of the complaints for the ombudsman, somewhere around 40%, come from jail. All of the complaints to the Office of Victims' Rights come from victims. And the reason that the Office of Victims' Rights is housed in the legislature, and it was a several-year process getting it created. It was vetoed by then-Governor Knowles at one time. It was a difficult decision where to house the Office of Victims' Rights. If you put it in the Department of Law, the complaints that a victim files in this scenario come against the district attorney, the public defender, OSPA, OPA, possibly public safety, could be a local law enforcement agency, APD of some kind. And we fixed that problem as a freshman, saying that OVR could go in and look at local law enforcement. So a complaint from a victim is going to be one against one of these agencies. So when it came time to create the office, you didn't want to house it in the Department of Law because you would be complaining against your boss, possibly. You're complaining against the DA, but all roads lead to the AG. If you put it in the Department of Administration, all roads lead to the commissioner, including the public defender and OPA. So it ended up being housed in the legislative branch as a separate ombudsman specialized for the victims of crime, not to answer to anybody. The OVR answers to us as a legislature, and the same as the ombudsman does. The ombudsman doesn't really have a direct oversight either, except to the legislature as an entity. That was the way that OVR was created, and what the legislation attempts to do is this inherent conflict between the potential of having, you know, worst case scenario, the same ombudsman representing a rapist and the rape victim at the same time and trying to have a resolution to that problem. We wanted to have a clear line, which, as Representative Stoltz says, I was in as a citizen in the creation of this as it came out of the the Victims' Rights Amendment to the Constitution in 94 in trying to flesh out these rights of victims. And I think that it is a lot clearer to the public, to the victims of the crime, to have a real bright line between these two things to make sure that there's absolutely never even the appearance of a conflict between who is representing who. And that's the purpose of House Bill 92.
Madam Chair, may I just add one thing?
Yes.
What Representative Samuels touched on was probably the most important thing in the genesis was this was the implementing agency for the constitutionally created Office of Victims Rights, or excuse me, Victims Rights Amendment. And that was, there was a, clearly the people of Alaska by a, by not just a supermajority, but a mega supermajority endorsed that Victims Rights Amendment to our Constitution. But there were a lot of problems in how it would be implemented, because they're just the inherent problems of the DA's office. They, as try as they do and so forth, they just have a hard time regulating themselves, and because, they, because they're obviously always working hard. But it's, it, it was, this agency was viewed as very important to have the mechanism to implement that. And that's a real substantive difference between the Ombudsman and the Office of Victims' Rights, is it has a direct link to that constitutional amendment. It is truly, as it was viewed by the sponsors and those involved, as the implementing agency for that, which wasn't being done as effectively as it could be.
Okay, questions for the bill sponsors?
I have a couple of questions.
Senator Green.
When Senator Halford and I, I think I co-sponsored it with Senator Halford when he was working on it. I never heard it called an ombudsman's office, one thing. And I'm a little concerned. This raises a question of institutional competency when the ombudsman lacks that special legal knowledge necessary to investigate. I don't think there are any limitations on what the ombudsman can do to get assistance and help. I would have preferred not to see certainly a sentence like that to denigrate another sister agency. And it was placed in the legislature at that time because the budget thing was a mess and no one wanted a new line item in their budget. And even we had to talk the legislature into accepting anything that posed, it looks like an increase to the legislative budget. And we still do that sometime, and we kind of shuffle around new agencies. If you want to address the issue of the what can or what should the ombudsman investigate, because I think the genesis of this problem is actually has to do with the representation of prisoners and the questions that come in through the correctional system, and that's the way to address that problem. And because there's currently a system of appeals, the court, all sorts of internal corrections ways to do that. But and I don't know if the Office of Victims' Rights ever reports to us, except for their little report they do, or we ever exert any authority over them. I know attempts are made each year on the ombudsman in the budget process, and I don't know if we do that to the Office of Victims' Rights. I would like to hear from both the Office of Victims' Rights and the ombudsman. Are they here?
We do have Kathy Hansen and Linda Lauren Jenkins on the line.
Thank you.
Okay, so further questions for the bill's sponsors. Can you guys stick around since they're online? Okay, let's go first to Kathy Hansen with the Office of Victims' Rights. Ms. Hansen, are you there? Good morning. Are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes. And did you follow Senator Green's line of questioning?
Yes, I did.
And could you respond?
Through the Chair, Senator Green, the the Office of Victims' Rights has two functions. One is to act as an ombudsman, a special ombudsman for crime victims, and the other is to advocate as a lawyer for crime victims who ask.
And do what? What was the second one?
To act as an advocate or a lawyer for crime victims who ask, to provide free legal advice and advocacy on crime victims' legal rights issues.
So does that mean you would actually go to court with them?
We do that. We file briefs, and we have client meetings, and we'll facilitate communication with the prosecutors and the police and ensure that timely prosecution is happening.
Senator Green?
Oh, okay. I don't know exactly understand. Does that mean you, if they wouldn't be part of the action, this would be in their role as an observer?
Well, crime victims have statutory and constitutional rights.
Okay,
but the right to confer, the right to be heard at the bail hearings and at sentencing. Sometimes we'll speak on behalf of the crime victim in that capacity. We're not a party, but victims do have a special role in the criminal process.
But in the court records, you would be listed as their attorney?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, yes.
I'm not Your Honor.
Yeah.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt again. But is my understanding correct that a criminal can get a public defender or OPA, someone like that? They get the state to pay for their lawyer. What this bill or what the Office of Victim Rights intends to do is sort of balance that, that if you've got an victim without substantial means, they can also then have a state-appointed lawyer. Is that too simple?
That's actually a really good way to phrase it. And the concern that we have with the jurisdiction over the Office of Victims' Rights and the Ombudsman is that we gather documents and represent the crime victim. We're bar-certified attorneys, all with prosecution or substantial criminal law experience. If they're unhappy with the outcome, then they go to the Ombudsman. There's a risk of them getting documents they shouldn't be getting, and I can answer that more fully if that raises more questions. And there's also the concern that there would be confusion or reversal or who's making the final decision. When the OVR statutes were drafted, it was the intent that there would be a specialized office to deal with these crime victims' legal issues that, you know, would have some teeth and would be the final say.
Does that answer your question, Senator Bundy?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, anything further, Ms. Hansen, that you'd like to put into the public record?
There are several things that the Ombudsman cannot access, such as active criminal investigations records from, like, cold cases, when a case is ongoing, that we can. And then if a crime victim wanted then later to ask the Ombudsman for review, we couldn't statutorily turn that over. There are several problems with the way 2455, the enabling statute for the Ombudsman, and 2465, the enabling statute for Office of Victims' Rights, where there are things we get that the Ombudsman doesn't. So if they were investigating us, it would be in contrary to statute for us to turn it over.
Could the person asking the question of the Ombudsman sign away the access to those records?
I think through the chair, what would need to happen is that you'd have to substantially revise AS 2455 for the Ombudsman if you wanted the Ombudsman to oversee the OVR. I think the easiest thing to do is to, and actually the best thing to do for crime victims, is to have the specialized knowledge of the Office of Victims' Rights looking at the issues and making the final decision on what action, if any, is needed to improve the system and improve the circumstances for that crime victim. For example, the reason this bill came up is that there was a case where there was an active criminal investigation, and our office looked at whether or not it was something that was viable for prosecution. We're experts at that, and we work with the DAs on helping to explain to the crime victims whether something is viable for prosecution. To have a non-lawyer, a person who doesn't have criminal investigation experience, then take it and oversee that would be unhelpful.
Senator French.
I have more of a comment than a question, but I've been thinking about this institutional competence argument. I appreciate Senator Green bringing up, because I also, it, I think there may be a legitimate issue about whether one agency should oversee another one, but that particular argument is very unpersuasive, at least to me. The DA's office is the person who's ultimately responsible for making that critical decision about whether to prosecute or not, and I'm fully and happy to have that decision. You know, if you're unhappy with that decision, go complain to an ombudsman, because ombudsmen aren't expert in any single field, right? You hire an ombudsman because they are good at processing information, they're good at looking at both sides, and they tend to make good judgments about issues. And they're almost always going to have to defer to the institutional competence, if you will, of the agency they're overseeing. And I imagine they do that in most instances. But the idea that it's sort of a decision too complex for someone else to review is not one that I embrace.
Okay, further questions? Okay, Linda Lord Jenkins. Are you there? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to answer the questions. I've been taking notes. As you may recall, I gave a presentation when we addressed this last year, mm-hmm. And I've been taking notes about some of the comments. I appreciate Senator French's comments about our institutional competence. We do have attorneys on staff, two of whom have been involved in criminal defense issues. The matter that brought this to a head was characterized as whether or not a sexual assault of a young woman was viable for prosecution. The complainant who came to my office did not complain that it was not handled as viable for prosecution. The complaint had to do with how the police agency treated the victim. The complainant was fully aware that it really was not a viable matter because both the alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator were mentally handicapped. And so the question was not whether or not they would be prosecuted. We assured the complainant at the time that we didn't think that it would be prosecutable. But she was more concerned about how the victim was handled by the police agency. And her allegation was that OVR did not go beyond talking to the police, did not to find out if it was viable for prosecution. She wanted the police agency to sort of look outside the box and refine and how they treated handicapped victims, which is a question that is really important in today's society. We have a lot of handicapped and disabled victims, and there is a movement afoot to try and get them better treatment at the hands of police officers and in the court system. So that was the issue, and what we wanted to find out when we made contact with OVR was who beyond the victim and the actual police reports did the investigator talk to? Did the investigator look at the issue of how the police handled this victim? And all accounts that we received from the complainant were that this victim was really victimized again, that she was kept up almost 24 hours being interrogated by police officers, who had every right to interrogate her, I want to add, but that she was not, she had very limited communication capabilities. She was not allowed to have a family member in the interrogation with her, and that this interrogation started at 3 in the morning after she had been awake most of the day and didn't end until about 9 in the morning. The complainant alleged that this was not reasonable treatment of a handicapped victim. We wanted to know what the non-attorney investigator looked at and talked to. We do understand that there are records that we don't have statutory access to, but we also do not provide records that we acquire from any agency to any complainant. That has been our longstanding policy. If complainants want records from agencies, we direct them to file an open records request. We do not act as a conduit for records from an agency to a complainant. We document our records. We mark the records that we get from complainants and agencies, so that simply does not happen. I'd be happy to answer any other questions. I know that OVR was modeled after the Ombudsman statute. My concern has been all along based in our belief that OVR statute does in fact not allow OVR to provide specific information about its investigations to the legislature. We believe that our statute, because it provides for confidentiality, confidential treatment of all documents and information, that we do have access to this statute. Our concern is that if we are no longer the oversight agency for OVR, then who is? That would be the one concern that I have here today.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Jenkins. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, and thank you for your work. Have there been other cases where you, where the Ombudsman's office has felt a need to review the activities of OVR?
We had one other case that came up at the same time that the case that I just mentioned. It had to do with a complaint by a person who believed he was a crime victim, and we referred him to OVR, and he came back and complained that OVR had not acted on his complaint, had not responded reasonably, and in fact, he alleged at some point that he was actually turned over to the troopers by OVR. He did not provide sufficient information. There were a lot of issues there, but we did ask the questions. Now, we have not conducted any formal investigations of OVR as defined in our statute. Since this bill was filed, we have been referring complainants to the director, and we have told complainants that at this point the question of our jurisdiction over OVR was being considered by the legislature. We referred OVR complaints to the director and then to the bill sponsors. We said, if you have a problem with how OVR is responding, these two people are very interested in OVR, and they would be good people for you to also talk to. But we route them through the process first.
Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Bundy.
And I'd encourage you to continue to do that. Some of us think that the legislature in general and specific legislators for their constituents are indeed do have some kind of an ombudsman role for their constituents. Could you address the question that the bill sponsors, or the idea the bill sponsors brought forward, that in your role as ombudsman, you might have the perpetrator's complaint while OVR could have the victim of that crime under their jurisdiction, and the two organizations might be working at cross purposes?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, it's no secret that the Ombudsman's Office handles a lot of complaints from inmates. 20-25% of our caseload on any given year is from inmates about the Department of Corrections. A very small percentage, probably less than 0.5%, might be filed against a prosecuting attorney. It is always possible that we might get a defendant and a victim. To my knowledge, that has never happened, and we keep pretty good track on the kinds of complaints that we get. If we see that there is a conflict, I mean, and I can only speak hypothetically, if I were to see that there is a conflict, I would assign one to one office and another complaint to the other office and direct that there be a wall erected between them. But when we get complaints from folks who are complaining that they're being prosecuted, we route them in. They have attorneys. There is a court process, and we route them to their attorneys. If we get a complaint that their attorney is not adequately representing them, if it's a private attorney, we have no jurisdiction over that because we don't have jurisdiction over the actions of private individuals. If it is a public defender or OPA attorney, our review is limited because we do not have statutory access to attorney-client records. However, we also believe that the client can waive that privilege. But the allegation would have to be incompetence and abuse of discretion. We do route people to the court process if they believe that their attorney is not representing them adequately. We tell them that they have the option of filing an ineffective assistance of counsel motion with the court. But we don't go in and address whether or not in-court representation is adequate. We have questions about whether or not the Bar Association does that. I have a legal opinion that was generated by my in-house counsel asking that question about whether or not the Bar Association actually does respond to ineffective assistance complaints adequately. It's our conclusion that they generally don't respond very well because of manpower questions. If we had a complaint from an inmate or an alleged defendant who complained that OVR was acting inappropriately in a matter, and I think that's what we might be getting at here, I think that I would probably decline that because OVR has a statutory obligation to represent crime victims. There are a lot of in-court solutions to defendants' complaints if they believe that OVR was acting improperly. But quite frankly, I can't fathom an instance where that might happen. Does that answer your question, Senator?
I think so, Madam Chair, if I might. So this disagreement then is evolved out of one incident then? Is that correct?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, that is my assessment. We had, prior to this disagreement, before when there was an acting advocate, we requested records from OVR that we didn't have a complaint against OVR. We had a complaint against the district attorney's office. OVR had been contacted by a burglary victim, and OVR was apparently unable to resolve the questions that the burglary victim had, but what had documents that the burglary victim had provided them. He authorized us to obtain these documents from OVR. OVR initially declined and then sought a legal opinion from Legislative Legal on whether or not we had the right to request these documents. Ledge Legal wrote an opinion that indicated that we did have the right to have those documents, and OVR provided those documents. It was evidence at that point. It wasn't criminal. I don't believe it was criminal records, but it was information that we needed that he had provided to OVR, and they ended up providing to us. But it wasn't a matter that we had a complaint against OVR. We were just getting evidence from them. So we periodically we get comments, complaints about OVR, and generally, like we do many complaints, we route people into their process, and frequently they don't come back because the process has been resolved their complaint.
And one last question, I
yes.
I'm a little confused. You said that you cannot have complete access to information that OVR has, but if the victim or whoever's involved with OVR provides a release, you can get access to the records, which is correct?
Well, our belief is that attorney-client privileges, if attorney-client privileges, a claim here belongs to the client, and that the client can waive that privilege. If OVR has records of active criminal complaints, OVR has argued here that they cannot provide those records to us. I wouldn't argue with that, but there are some records that we could conceivably get. If OVR records of contact with the complainant, notes that they have taken about their interviews with the complainant, those would not, in my view, and I'm not an attorney, would not classify as criminal investigation records. So I believe that we have access to those.
Okay, thank you. And so if I might, Madam Chair, the you would like to continue to have oversight of OVR, even though at some level you could not have complete information?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I believe that we do have oversight over OVR. I believe that, all agencies should have oversight over them. My concern is that if the Ombudsman's Office is removed from oversight, then there will really be no oversight over OVR. So that is why I'm opposing the bill.
Thank you. And I look forward to sponsors' response.
Yeah, and one point to continue to raise is that, you know, the Office of Victims' Rights is staffed with attorneys who do have a professional code of conduct. So in and of itself, there's a whole system that oversees that in terms of the bar. Is there a response, Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Madam Chair. getting down to the kind of the whole crux of the bill, the way that I've seen this is there are two ombudsman's office, and one of them is you'd be fighting over where the buck stops. And if a victim doesn't like a decision that OVR has made, the ombudsman is saying, you can go to me. Well, what if you don't like a decision that the ombudsman makes? Is where does it stop? That's the fundamental question. And the bill, the idea says that for something that's going through OVR, it stops here and it goes to the legislature. If it goes to the ombudsman, it stops there and then it goes to the legislature. To say the statement, there will be no oversight over OVR, well, there's no oversight over the ombudsman. I get complaints all the time that say the ombudsman didn't do this, and quite frankly, I look at most of them as a sour grapes. You know, they did their investigation, you didn't get your way, and then with the OVR, it's a similar thing. I view them as sister agencies with no oversight. If not, then who's overviewing the ombudsman? And that's what it is. And Senator Bundy, I took your line of questioning. You spent a lot of time on this, and I appreciate that, Madam Chairman. We're trying to draw the line, and that's all we're trying to do is saying these are separate agencies. If you're the victim of a crime and you want to use OVR right here, that's fine. But to complain about them, then we're going to have to set something up to complain about the ombudsman now. And as far as Senator Green's comments were on the other problems, I would wholeheartedly agree with you. Wholeheartedly agree with you.
Well, Senator Green, I don't know if Kathy Hansen wants to address what ombudsman questions or Office of the Ombudsman questions have come to them. But it did not sound like they were questioning the work of OVR, but whether or not they had observed something from the report about at the police station. And simply, had they followed up on that? Maybe they don't consider that their purview. I don't know. But it didn't sound like they were saying, oh, you made a decision here, and we're questioning that. And if I misunderstood it, are we addressing something, a problem that really doesn't exist? Or is there more out there that we haven't heard about? I
well, and I think it just raises an example of where you could have, you know, these kinds of problems continue to arise, where you've got the ombudsman investigating essentially a victim's ombudsman who investigates them, and you go round and round and round. It's a bit circular.
We have tried, Madam Chair, and I don't want to beat the horse to a pulp here, but we have had legislation, Representative Stoltz and I have had legislation that would actually give standing, in court standing, to the Office of Victims' Rights, and we couldn't get past the legal tanglings of evidentiary rule or everything, but constantly trying to get access for the victims into the system. And before this, and I can tell you, I was involved in this system before there was an Office of Victims' Rights, and I didn't go to the ombudsman. I would pick up the phone and I would yell at Susan Parks. And that's what I would do. And that was my only out. And I feel sorry she has become a friend of mine now, actually. But at the time, I would call up Susan Parks and just yell at her. So there was no avenue of where a victim could go and get legal advice without trying to hire your own attorney, which I also tried to do.
But we've solved that problem.
Senator Green.
You've solved that problem through the chair. Through the chair, we've solved that problem. And now, you're taking this agency, this what I would call an ombudsman for victims agency, and if you are able to bypass their work and their decisions and simply go to the other ombudsman, I think that you will end up over time deteriorating that. And maybe it will never happen again. Maybe we're wrong, but I think we're better safe than sorry with drawing the line right now and saying we've got two agencies.
Madam Chairman, I would like to see when the OVR first began being called an ombudsman. Because I think you conveniently, do you recall that from the authorship of the legislation?
Madam Chair, Senator Green, it was a term frequently used. We, the testimony, I could probably pull a lot, dredge a lot out of the minutes. It was a term we used very often. We called it an ombudsman for victims' rights. We referenced that we were modeling it after the ombudsman statute. And I'd like to say I remembered side by side specifically, but you know, that was the intent. Though I can, having been on the, and it was the whole genesis was the constitutional amendment was passed in 1994, and there really wasn't the ombudsman's office wasn't effective in implementing the DA's office, and it wasn't through any fault. They didn't have the expertise, and it was almost equated with This agency was not only an ombudsman, but almost like a foreign language translator for victims who were thrust in a situation as a victim. They're going into a system where people literally speak a foreign language, and the attorneys basically escorted them through. And they were, you know, the terminology is used. The defendant had their attorney or the public defender, and the certainly the prosecutor was there, but they were on a roll. Sometimes dealing a lot with the victim was counterproductive in many ways because it's time, you know, sensitive, but it's also very important given the constitutional amendment. And this was really to bring the victim out of the shadow of justice was the terminology used, and this was the only way that by creating that separate agency. Ombudsman was a term used, and we had to use it to describe it. This will be just like the ombudsman through several incarnations when the bill originally went through and was vetoed, I think, in 2000, and then when it passed in 2001.
Okay, and we're going to wrap up debate here. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, I was going to point out that I have another meeting, and I know you have a lot of work to do yet. You know, it's a turf battle. And I would just call for the question.
Okay, question called. Before a question is called, is there anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill 92? Anyone online? Hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us. And is there a motion? Senator Bundy.
I move House Bill 92 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, the motion is to move House Bill number 92, individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note. Is there an objection? Okay, hearing and seeing none, House Bill 92 is moved. That brings us to...
Thank you.
Yes, House Bill number 196. And then we're going to go to Darfur, Senate Bill 227. Stick around, Ralph. Okay, bill sponsors. We'll take a brief at ease while we circulate the. Here we go. We're back in order. We're on the record, and we have House Bill number 196 before us. Representative Ramirez, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. It's such a privilege to be before you. Madam President, through the chair, it is a privilege to be, believe me. Depends on your point of view. We're here delighted to present House Bill 196, which is handling matters after a person's death. We think that that this is an excellent update on wills and related material. It's a little bit esoteric in nature. And we have had, Madam Chair, through the help of Senate Labor and Commerce, is that we went through some changes that we will want to bring to your attention took into consideration some of the concerns of Senator Bundy. We would look for some direction from the Chair. We have heard an issue of anatomical gifts, which is also germane to this subject matter. We have heard this bill in two committees on the House side. It was a bill that was brought forward by Representative Wilson on the House side as a Hess bill, and heard and passed out of the Hess committee, and then we heard it in the House Judiciary Committee. And with the permission of the bill sponsor, Representative Wilson is the chair of Hess. She encouraged us to roll it into this piece of legislation. So at the discretion of the chair, we are prepared to offer this with House Bill 196 with anatomical, it's House Bill 420 would be the reference. We're prepared to offer this with House Bill 420 rolled into House Bill 196, or to take it up in the next committee of referral, if that's appropriate. I'm going to have Jane Pearson take you through the bill itself, and then we have professional testimony to get into the more esoteric provisions of the bill. And we are going on the floor, so with the permission of the chair, I'll excuse myself, but thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Sponsor leaves. I just have to point out these strange marriages are brought about by a 90-day session.
He couldn't let it pass, Representative Ramirez. And we apologize for delaying you for session. Thank you for being around.
If we had 120 days, we could talk about this more.
That's true.
Jane, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez and House Judiciary Committee aide. And House Bill 196 clarifies and updates Alaska statutes governing states. And House Bill 196 can be broken into three parts. It provides that a penalty clause for contesting a will or instituting other proceedings applies even if probable cause exists for instituting the proceedings. And this aligns wills with similar provisions in revocable trusts, which are often used in wills. So there is a rationale for doing this. It also amends 1316. 680A to change the statement in an affidavit to be used by a decedent successor to collect personal property in a small estate. And this was changed in Senate L&C, I believe by amendment by Senator Bundy. And it would raise the limit to $100,000 for personal property. That was what was raised. It is currently $15,000 in statute. As we brought the bill forward, it was $25,000. This exception would also account for $100,000 in vehicles. And the third part of this bill is it lays out protections for benefits paid under life insurance and retirement plans so that debtors could not get into that money. And that's basically what the three provisions of this bill and what it does.
Okay, question. Senator Bundy.
I'm looking at the CS here. Your intention to adopt the CS?
I will accept whatever motion is made. There's version K, which includes anatomical gifts, and if that motion is made, I will just simply declare a conflict because I have a bill on this side. This is Representative Wilson's bill, but if I would just declare a conflict. Otherwise, if members would like to move the other version, that's fine with me.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion to move the CS for House Bill 196 /K Bannister as okay. Our working document.
Okay, and is there an objection to that motion? Okay, and so I'll just note on the record, as I did before in the similar legislation, my father sits on the Life Alaska Board, which has advocacy over encouraging Alaskans to donate organ and tissue. And so should someone object or? Okay, so it's noted on the record. Okay, so we have version K before us, and we do have some folks to answer questions and testify.
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Green.
Do we have any trust attorneys or any of those guys
online?
Yes,
we do.
Okay,
we do.
Okay, very good.
Absolutely. And so why don't we start out with Steve Greer. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am, Senator McGuire.
Fantastic. Did you want to offer just a brief bit about the trust matters and then answer questions?
Yes, I would. Section 1 of the bill brings wills in conformity with present trust laws that now exist in our statutes. Section 2 and 3, which is the subject of the amendment in Senate Labor and Commerce, raises the amount whereby it's not necessary to go through a probate process if a decedent dies with less than a certain amount of property. Our present law is $15,000. It was felt that this was entirely too low. It has not, that statute had not been amended since the early 80s. I indicated in the previous hearing before Senate Labor and Commerce that Oregon has a statute which says that personal property should be raised to $50,000. That's their statute. And it also has a provision for real estate. Washington has a provision dealing solely with personal property, as we do, but Washington has raised the amount to $100,000. There's been some concern about the most recent amendment of raising it to $100,000, that this could be a way that beneficiaries could abuse it, where one person, let's say one bad brother, as my example, goes into the bank with an affidavit, gets the money, and doesn't turn it over to the other individuals who might be entitled to that money. It should be noted, however, that if that the affidavit procedure cannot occur until at least 30 days after the death of a decedent, and so it is possible within that period of time to have someone appointed as a personal representative, which would render this affidavit procedure moot. And an offended party can always go back to the court and get a personal representative appointed and get an order turning the money over. But if the money's gone, the money is gone. It was felt within the group that $100,000 was a bit high. $25,000, perhaps too low. $50,000 was an amount I know that everyone could live with, although no one really objects if it came to pass with the $100,000 amount. Section 4 is very, very important. Under the law as it now stands, let us say that an individual had a business calamity and there was a huge judgment against them and that he wanted to make sure that his spouse and child would continue on, so he purchases a life insurance policy. Under the law as it now stands, if the money is paid directly to an individual, it would be exempt from creditor claims. On the other hand, let us say that you've got the money being paid to a minor child. If it's paid in trust for the benefit of the minor child, it would not, there's no statutory provision protecting those proceeds. And so this is Section 4 is meant to fill a void that presently exists on our law. And that's really the extent of my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, Mr. Gert, Senator Bundy.
Oh, I didn't have a question.
No question. Any questions for Mr. Greer? Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greer, maybe you could turn back to Section 1.
Yes.
I understand this is making us consistent with trusts, but this looks like a long-standing provision of law that we're reversing, and I could maybe you can just give me a couple of examples about why this is important to have.
Well, Section 1 is really a penalty clause. For instance, let us say that and let me respond, Senator French, to the chair. Section 1 is a provision whereby, let us say, a decedent wanted to leave property solely to one child to the exclusion of the other child. Here, it's but they're leaving the child who isn't to receive as much, let's say, a sum of, say, $25,000. What this does, and if the decedent chose to include a incontestability clause, which says that if the person who was to receive the lesser amount, and this was the choice of the decedent, were to contest this thing, and if they were to lose, then they are being put to the test because they very well may lose the $25,000 amount that they would otherwise receive. On the other hand, if it turns out that the will is done fraudulently or under duress and the will is thrown out, then, of course, this clause doesn't apply at all. It should be noted that California, for instance, has a very similar provision. This was a part of our Uniform Probate Code that was enacted in the early 80s, and needless to say, there have been many, many changes that have been made in this code by other states. We have, decided this year that we should bring this in line with our present trust statutes, which have been, brought current with other states.
Senator French.
Mr. Greer, why would it not apply? You say it would not apply, but it's there it is, clear as daylight, that a provision in a will purporting to penalize an interested person for contesting a will relating to a state is enforceable even if probable cause exists for instituting proceedings. If I institute proceedings because I think there's been fraud, and a judge finds there's probable cause to support my belief that there's been fraud, there, black and white on the books, it says, sorry, that penalty provision is enforceable.
Senator French, through the chair, in that case, what would happen is that the will would be thrown out, and the incontestability clause would have no force at all, have no force in effect at all. So I would have to disagree with your conclusion there. What it does say is this. It says that if a person, in this example, were to bring a cause of action, and it turned out that they lost. Okay, probable cause and winning the case are two different standards. And it turns out that they lost the case. It wasn't shown that it was done under duress. And this was truly reflects the decedent's intent. Then the person who brought the cause of action would be penalized for having brought that cause of action. And it's really meant to prevent needless and miscellaneous litigation that sometimes occurs in decedent's estate when one individual doesn't get what they feel they're entitled to receive through the choice of a decedent. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes and no. I have great concerns about this section. It just it seems like it prevents people from having an opportunity to have their claims heard, it makes them walk away when there's probable cause to believe that there's something wrong with the will.
I do want to make a personal, Senator French, through the chair, I do want to make a personal comment. I personally do almost all of my estate planning through revocable trust. And not through wills, because I would like to avoid the whole probate process to begin with. This was a provision that there is a group of us, as you well know, who are trying to keep our laws current with other states. This was a provision that was felt by that group that needed to be included to make our will laws, conform with our trust laws, which in turn compete with those laws of other states. I understand your point of view, and I can't dispute it. But I will say there is a protective provision here. I mean, it does put the aggrieved party to the test. If it's felt that they've got a strong case and they prevail, then, of course, the will would be thrown out, and they would be entitled to receive what they would probably be entitled to receive if the decedent had died intestate. If, in fact, however, it's found that the case was brought for harassment purposes or was brought for purposes of essentially trying to hold the decedent's estates hostage by bringing this litigation, it's meant to prevent that type of action.
This is one of those issues that's difficult because it would depend on what side of the equation you sat on. However, when you think about the business of attracting individuals who want as much enforceability in the drafting of the wills that then carry forward their assets, it's likely that those individuals want those provisions to be as enforceable as possible. And so I think the perspective that you guys are coming from to stay competitive with the industry is that you want to draw more business here, people who want to go ahead and place their money here and under Alaska law. However, if you were the person who didn't get what you thought you should, you probably wouldn't particularly love this provision. So I see both sides. Senator Bunny?
Well, again, I guess another turf battle. And I fall down on the side of the deceased. Their last will and testament, their final wishes should, in my mind, have the greater precedent here, the greater impact. And if somebody's misfortune to be in a non-functional, dysfunctional family, and they don't want to encourage bad behavior by someone that would be an heir, they ought to be able to have the ability to say, no, I'm writing them out, and shape up, or you're going to stay written out.
That's right. Yep. Okay. Any further questions for Steve Greer this time? Okay, there are none. Anyone else? I have Dick Thwaites. Is he on the line? Okay, anyone else here in the audience wishing to testify on the CS for House Bill number 196? Anyone online that I've overlooked? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then that brings us back before us for committee discussion. Senator Bundy.
I'm ready for a motion if you are.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
I have another meeting to go to. Yes. Madam Chair, I would move CS for House Bill 196 from committee with individual recommendations attached fiscal note.
Okay, CS for House Bill number 196, individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, it has moved. Thank you to everyone here, and thank you, Jane. And we'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record here, and it is 10:30. We are getting close to the end of the 90-day session and close to the end of this hearing. And we're going to go ahead then and bring up House Bill 351 because it's a pretty simple bill, and I'd hate to hold it up over going from two to one sets of fingerprints here. So House Bill 351, and we have the bill's sponsor's representative.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Karen Litzter, and I am staff to Representative John Carkill, and I appreciate you taking the time to hear this simple bill. And it does exactly what you said. We have new technology, so the requirement for an application for a concealed handgun permit is no longer necessary. One set of fingerprints is all the Department of Public Safety needs. However, the requirement for the two sets was in statute, so we are asking for this change. When we spoke with Department of Public Safety about this, they also asked if we could add in the fact that the fingerprint card could be submitted on their form rather than the Federal Bureau of Investigation approved card. So those two very simple changes are what we are requesting with this bill. Thank you.
Okay, questions for the bill's sponsor's representative, Senator French.
It's still 10 fingers, right? It's just one set of 10 fingers.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator French, that is correct.
Unless you're Jim Holm.
That's
unless
my only
made an anatomical gift.
That's right.
I guess that's why we said complete. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Complete for what you've got. Okay.
For a motion?
Yes. Well, first of all, just briefly, is there anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill 351? Anyone online? Okay, so hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed. Brings the bill back before us. Senator Green.
I would move House Bill 351 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, 351 has moved.
Thank you very much.
And thank you. And that brings us to Senate Bill 227, divesting investments in the Sudan. And Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just be one sec.
Just to take an at ease.
I'm ready.
Okay.
My book out. Thanks, Madam Chair. This bill is really a straightforward question for the committee. It's about as easy to understand as any Sunday school lesson. There is genocide happening in Sudan. Genocide means the deliberate extermination of an ethnic or national group. The State Department, the United States State Department, has called it genocide. So has President Bush. This genocide is being conducted by the Sudanese government. Tens of thousands of human beings have been murdered. Viewed this way, our duty is clear. We must not allow any of our Alaskan dollars to further this terror. This bill takes the approach known as targeted divestment. And divestment works, Madam Chair. Indeed, divestment works in the Sudan. In 1997, the United States declared sanctions against the Sudanese government and got them to drop their support for terrorists and to cooperate with the U.S. on counterterrorism. The focus in this bill is on companies with active business operations in Sudan. As you consider the bill, keep in mind that not a single United States company is doing business in Sudan currently and has not been doing business there since 1997, when those sanctions I earlier referred to were put into place. 14 states, including Texas, Arizona, Kansas, Florida, and North Carolina, have targeted divestment laws like this one aimed at the Sudan. The detractors of the bill acknowledge the righteousness of the cause of divestment from Sudan, but point to two problems. One, the slippery slope argument. That is, if Sudan, why not stop investing in tobacco or South Africa? And the answer to that is the same answer, really, as to any slippery slope argument, and that is, this case is not that one. There is a large difference between genocide and smoking cigarettes. There's a large difference between genocide and other social investment policies. I think we can all agree that we should not invest in companies that are helping a government kill their own citizens. The second argument is that it costs us money to do so. Well, that may be true, although I think the costs are wildly overstated. In my view, no one at this table would knowingly invest in a company that's sponsoring genocide. Why would we choose to do so as a state? Thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Senator French. Questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we do have public testimony, and we'll go ahead and start out with Dixie Hood. Dixie, welcome to Senate State Affairs. Please put yourself on the record and go ahead and offer your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Dixie Hood, and I am a 30-year resident of Alaska and a licensed marriage and family therapist. And I've been the beneficiary of the permanent fund dividend and am definitely supporting humanitarian concerns over any possible profits. The international boycott of business in the Union of South Africa years ago did contribute to the ending of apartheid in that country. And so I just want to state that I support SB 227 and its restricting of state investments in Sudan until human rights abuses in Darfur have been halted and not resumed for a period of 12 months.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hood, for your testimony. Are there questions? Okay, thank you. Appreciate your patience as well today. Roger Severson. Okay. We have Helena Fagan. Welcome. And thank you, too, for your patience.
Morning. Obviously, the facts are clear, and they've been stated over and over by people, so I'm going to just take a little bit of your time and give you my my own background and why I care about this bill. My name is Helena Fagan. I am a resident of Juneau. My mother spent her early years, her teen years, in the Lodz Ghetto in Poland, in Auschwitz, and in Bergen-Belsen. My great-grandparents, we think, were gassed in a truck and then dumped in the mass graves at Chelmno. My grandfather died in a work camp. My grandmother died in Auschwitz gas chambers. My mother is now part of a network of survivors who worked for more than 10 years to create the Holocaust Memorial in Washington Park in Portland, Oregon. And I traveled with that group to all of the death camps in Poland where we collected soil to deposit in the foundation of the memorial. The soil holds ashes and bone fragments. The mass grave sites we saw, especially where my great-grandparents were dumped, were as large as football fields. Standing there, I felt the energy of death, fear, and violence that is still filling the air there. For the last 20 years or so, my mother has spoken to countless students and other audiences about her experiences. In fact, she spoke twice here in Juneau, invited by the Rotary Club for their Pillars of America program. Every time she spoke, she had nightmares afterwards. But she continued to speak all those years because she wanted people, especially young people, to understand what happens when hatred grows and it's supported by indifference. Just last month, she decided, when she was asked to come up and speak here one more time, that she's done speaking, at least for now. She's 78, she's battling health issues, and she's just tired. So I figure now it's my turn to speak. So this is the first time I've testified, but, you know, it's my turn. Indifference killed my family, every bit as much as hatred did. My grandfather tried for years to get his family out of Poland. Nobody would help. Nobody would listen. The United States wouldn't let him in, even though he had money. He had all the appropriate paperwork. He was a wealthy landowner. But they had to wait and wait and wait, and it didn't work. My mother was finally allowed to enter America after the war, many months after she was liberated from Bergen-Belsen, after she was carried out on a stretcher, too emaciated and fevered with typhus to stand, but using the only English she knew to try to convince her liberators that she could still work, that if they didn't kill her, she would work. During this past month, while people continue to be exterminated in Darfur, I've listened to our state leaders discuss the reasons that they hesitate to support SB 227. I mean, who wants to open this can of worms, the slippery slope? And I believe the director of the Permanent Fund when he says that financial gain is his directive, that the bottom line is to make money. And I believe him when he says if we sell the stock in those companies invested in Darfur, that somebody else will just buy them. Of course, that's all true. But I also believe that we can have financial gain without contributing to suffering. And I believe that we must not be indifferent to genocide and hatred. When I told my mother yesterday on the phone that I planned to testify today and explained what this was about and that we must keep asking the question, when does never again begin, I was actually shocked by her response. She said to me, you know, only Holocaust survivors and their children say that. Nobody else says that. You're wasting your time. So I'm hoping today that you'll prove her wrong and pass this bill along. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mike Burns.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Michael Burns, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I'm joined today by Laura Ashe, the corporation's Director of Communications. First of all, I would like to say that we sincerely appreciate the motivation that has led to the introduction of this legislation. We are profoundly disturbed by the incomprehensible situation that is taking place in Darfur. And we respect that it is the legislature's prerogative to direct us in how to invest the Alaska Permanent Fund. If the legislature directs the trustees and staff to divest the assets from the fund in the manner described in the bill, we will do so. However, we urge you to think carefully before you take this step. In 30 years, the Alaska Permanent Fund has only been invested for the financial benefit of the people of Alaska and never to enact a social or political agenda. Placing a social investment directive on the fund would be a significant change to our core mission. We believe that the prudent course of action is to make investment decisions based strictly on economic grounds, and we do not believe that investment decisions made for social or political reasons are in the best interests of the permanent fund. After the question of prudence is the question of efficacy. We are concerned by the prospect of placing a socially motivated directive on the permanent fund. a directive that will have some cost when we have not seen definitive proof that these divestments efforts are or have been effective. To support our point, we have included a summary of a paper in your bill packets that reviews the effect that divestment from South African investments had on the decision to end apartheid. The researchers concluded that it was not divestment, but rather many other forms of pressure brought to bear on the South African government that caused the change in their practices. Before I conclude, I would like to touch on some concerns held by the United States Treasury and the United States State Department, both of which are actively involved in trying to bring about an end to genocide in Darfur. We certainly don't speak for these agencies, but choosing to enact divestment legislation is a significant decision that will affect our state's investments and investment policies well into the future, and we think you should have all the facts as you deliberate. We have included testimony in your packet from representatives of these federal agencies before the Senate Banking Committee in Washington, and you will find that the common theme is that the Treasury and state believe that individual divestment policies at state level, rather than helping, will in fact hinder their efforts. In addition, I think you should know that independent studies of the sovereign wealth funds of the world, which have included the Alaska Permanent Fund, have ranked us in the upper decile for best practices. These practices include making investment decisions on solely financial grounds. I appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns as you make this very important decision. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burns. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony, and certainly I share your concern and appalled by how inhuman some humans can be to their fellow men. And I'm concerned about efficacy as well. My question was one of the ones that were actually around here and voted to establish the permanent fund. And as I remember, I used to keep a part of the voter pamphlet on the wall where it said things about the earnings to be available for appropriation when oil revenues have diminished. I remind that to some of my weak-hearted colleagues from time to time. But a little editorializing as we go through this process.
Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Sorry, that's I'm true, not that's talking true. About you.
Okay, good.
There must be a question here.
Yeah. Yeah, don't you agree?
It's getting worse as the session goes on.
My question is, I want to know about the constitutional language that framed the permanent fund from which you take your direction to invest for the greatest return. We know that there's other legislation going through the process that considers assets of the state that are not available for initiative, and that assets of the state are supposed to be used for the good of all the people of Alaska. Was there some constitutional directive that would impact divestment issues?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, in the Constitution, there are only two things about the permanent fund. One is that 25% of the revenue or the royalties available to the state will be diverted to a permanent fund, and the other is the protection of the corpus of the fund in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the only matters that are actually in the Constitution. Everything else that we do is statutory, and I don't the statutory directive that we have today is to invest for maximum return while protecting the principle of the fund, I believe is the language. So that is statutory. So
there's not a constitutional issue. Okay, thank you.
Okay, further questions for Mr. Burns. Senator French.
Just a little, just to ask Mr. Burns if he's read some of the Sudan divestment materials that cite that three companies, they point out, that have changed their operations in Sudan as a result of divestment activities. One is CHC Helicopter Corporation, the largest provider of helicopter services in the global offshore oil and gas industry, previously a highly scrutinized company, that's a term of art inside the bill in Sudan, recently ceased all business operations in Sudan. for the indefinite future after substantial levels of inquiry from a range of concerned investors. That's one. The other company is Rolls-Royce. We've all heard of them. They sell oil engineering equipment to Sudan. They announced their decision to leave there, citing, in quoting from the company, increasing international humanitarian concerns about the situation in Darfur. Finally, a company from Germany called Siemens, shortly thereafter, one of their largest companies indeed in Germany, pledged to pull out of the country, also citing the pressure created by divestment as a factor. Roberta Cohen of the Brookings Institute, a think tank, said, in the view of some analysts, divestment campaigns may prove more effective than sanctions. Rolls-Royce's withdrawal from the Sudan this past year reportedly surprised the government and affected the import of needed machine parts. The Sudanese government has publicly urged an end to divestment actions, underscoring the potential sting of their impact. Does that change your view about the efficacy of divestment policies?
Well, through the chair, Senator French, I was not aware. I had not seen that report. I think the concept of embarrassing a government that's taking part in this kind of activity is very difficult. I think they're beyond embarrassment, and I don't think we're going to jawbone these people into doing the right thing.
So you dispute the
I don't dispute that. I was not aware of it.
Okay. We'll make sure you get a copy of that. And I guess I'd ask you to reconsider in the light of the fact that three major corporations have ceased operations there. If no corporations would help the Sudanese government kill their own citizens, they wouldn't be able to do it. Correct?
Well, and let's try to keep us from casting.
No, Madam Chair, I didn't mean to overstep a bound, I don't mean any harm, you know, to Mr. Yes. Burns, but it's a reality that's happening on the planet right now.
Yes.
It's happening with help of corporations that supply, you know, trucks, bolts, all the facilities you need to keep that machinery going, and if they didn't have that machinery, they couldn't do it. And so I didn't mean
Understood.
To step over the line.
No,
I apologize if I did.
Understood.
None taken.
Yeah.
Understood. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. And again, it's the efficacy thing that bothers me. I have not read the reports that you referenced from the State Department, but my limited understanding of violence in Africa, the weapon of choice is a machete and probably doesn't involve the Rolls-Royce company. But my concern is, and I'm wondering from your reading of those reports, if you could share your view, is that we limit the amount of investment that goes to the Sudan. Does that keep the leaders who are these evil people from having lunch, or does that just mean that those poor people who are being abused would have less food?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, not being aware of the withdrawal of Rolls-Royce and the other two companies that Senator French talked about, I guess I would answer your question from the perspective of if, in fact, we divested of our holdings, and I think there's four companies, maybe five, I'm not quite sure how many we have right now, what effect that would have on anything. I mean, if we sell, the only way we can sell is somebody else buys. So how has that harmed the company and therefore harmed the government? That's where I'm.
Senator Bundy?
Yeah, well, just, and I do have another meeting I have to go to. Just would like to make a comment. I would very much like to see this genocide stopped, and I'm personally, and a little foreign relation experience I have, thinks that it will be boots on the ground by the United Nations and other African nations that are serious about stopping this. I mean, divestment might, over years, have an impact, but how many people will die in the interim? I think there are much quicker ways to protect these people, and that's a shame that there aren't nations in this world willing to do that.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Further questions for Mr. Burns?
Just before the Senator leaves, just so he knows, the bill is aimed to not affect any company that's providing any humanitarian aid. If you're importing food, if you're importing groceries, if you're importing, you know, grocery store, you know, lighting equipment and refrigeration equipment, you're not affected. It's really, the bill is, that's why it's a targeted divestment rather than a sort of a global divestment. But that's just a technical issue in the bill.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further questions for Mr. Burns? Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, Mr. Burns. What would, practically, if this were to pass, what would it mean to your operation? How would you figure out which are companies that you morally should not invest in and which are companies you morally should? Can you have any comments on that?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, there are lists available developed by various organizations. We haven't thought through all of that exactly. We would purchase the lists, try to determine what which ones were on all the list or more of the list, and try to and then have to deal with our managers. It's the monitoring. It's in the index funds where some of these holdings might be held. Where, you know, you're either an index or you're not in the index. And if it's a customized index, it's a different price than an index. If you invest in an index fund of the S&P 500, you are in the S&P 500. If you, with billions of other dollars, if you're in the S&P 498, you have a custom benchmark, and people have to manage that differently at a different expense level. And that's what we tried to reflect in the fiscal note.
Okay, Senator French.
And just to keep in mind, though, the problem is when you use the word S&P, you know that this S&P doesn't include any targeted companies.
I probably should. I'm sorry. I should have used IFA. I'm sorry.
It's
an international index, and I stand corrected.
And it's a fair point. It's just it's important to keep in mind that not a single U.S. company is doing business there, so the S&P 500 would still be something we could invest in.
IFA, an IFA index.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Commissioner Galvin.
Long time no see, huh?
Yes.
Yes.
I know. Actually,
nice to be back
it has
in town.
Been. I was thinking that too. We've got a few geo questions for you.
Those are coming.
Okay.
Yes, for the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. With me is Brian Andrews, Deputy Commissioner in charge of the Treasury section of the department.
Good morning. Good morning.
We're here to testify. The administration supports SB 227. We recommend that it be moved out of this committee to the Finance Committee. We believe that the bill properly reflects a proactive manner action against genocide in Darfur by divesting in the companies that profit from those activities. The situation in Darfur is an ongoing human tragedy, and we have an opportunity, which is an unprecedented opportunity here, to take a proactive stand against those atrocities. With the uniqueness of this opportunity demonstrated by both Congress and the Department of State having labeled the situation as genocide, and we believe the congressional designation of it being genocide as it's actually occurring is an unprecedented situation. And with that legislation, there were also language that would tend to shield potentially the decisions of social investing that may otherwise be subject to potential claims based upon other precedent. And we are working with the Department of Law to look at how that congressional action may affect decisions absent the passage of this legislation to allow the administration to actually take certain actions with regard to divestiture that would still be compliant with the state investment laws. And we will continue to look at that with Department of Law absent movement on this legislation. But we do identify areas of legislation that we believe should be amended, and we would like to work with the sponsors of the legislation, perhaps in the Finance Committee, to try to eliminate some of the burdens with regard to the machinery of how this bill would affect the divestiture in order to minimize some of the costs that don't change the core principle of affecting the divestiture of state funds in this manner. And we believe also, as was identified by Mr. Burns, that there may be some additional language to shield some of the investment decisions that really aren't something that we can manage and affect, such as passive investments in some of the index funds that are probably ones that should properly be shielded from this. And we'd like to work with the sponsors on that. But we believe that it is a difficult decision, and it is something that the state has avoided in the past. But we believe that the situation at our four is unique, and it is a situation that we can identify and keep from approaching that so-called slippery slope as we move to ensure that the state funds are not invested in a way that would result in any chance contributing to the suffering that's occurring in Darfur. With that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Okay, questions?
Just a comment to thank you, Commissioner, and the Governor for her support of the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, next I have Deborah Bach in Anchorage. Just have three more.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, good morning, Deborah, and thank you for your patience.
Good morning. My name is Deborah Bach, and I'm a volunteer member of Save Darfur Anchorage. And at the risk of repeating what other people have said, I just want to remind you that last year, the Sudan Accountability and Divestment Act was passed by Congress and signed by the President of the United States. The act prohibited targeted foreign companies from receiving any contracts with the federal government because of their complicity with the ongoing genocide in Darfur. The act also provides authorization and encouragement for states to adopt policies of targeted divestment. This act has opened the door for each state to divest from the foreign oil, mining, and power companies that are providing documented, substantial support to the government of Sudan in its genocidal campaign. 24 states have adopted or are considering Sudan divestment policies. When Arizona joined the Sustain Group last month, all 90 Arizona lawmakers supported the legislation. Now it's our turn to take action. Senate Bill 227 would require the Permanent Fund Corporation and the Alaska Retirement Management Board to implement targeted divestment. Targeted divestment means selling off holdings in companies that have been identified by multiple international organizations as having documented complicity in the Darfur genocide. We sell those foreign holdings and purchase holdings in American companies that are genocide-free. It's that simple. Our permanent fund has roughly $22 million invested in six foreign companies that are linked to genocide. For two of these companies, Sinopec and CNPC Hong Kong, the government of China is the majority shareholder. China, however, is also the leading small arms dealer to the government of Sudan. Between 2003 and 2006, China sold $55 million worth of small arms to the government of Sudan. These weapons, in turn, have been used by the government of Sudan against citizens of Sudan, the people of Darfur. This is the first time in history that the United States Congress and the United States President have labeled atrocities a genocide while they are occurring. I'd like to thank Senator French for taking the bold step to sponsor this legislation for Alaska. Targeted divestment isn't about sacrificing profits for the greater good. There are many, many genocide-free investment options that are equally profitable. I will be a proud Alaskan the day that my state enacts a policy of targeted divestment from Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I have two more folks, and if you're people that support the bill, then you might like to keep your testimony as brief as possible because it's 11 now and we have to go to the floor. So if you could keep it brief, I would appreciate it. Joanne Bloom. Okay, thank you, Ms. Bloom. And then finally, Max Crows.
Hello?
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Max Crows with the Sudan Divestment Task Force and Genocide Intervention Network, a registered 501c3 nonprofit organization with the mission to empower individuals and communities with the tools to stop and prevent genocide. Today I wanted to briefly address some of the points with the legislation and provide a brief background of how corporations are identified for divestment, as that's been a question that's before the committee, and also respond to a couple
Senator French wants to communicate with you.
Mr. Crows, I think we're in pretty good shape on this bill. We're running very, very short of time. I know you've got a lot to tell us, but if you can keep it to like under a minute, that'd be really good.
Certainly. The two points that I would make in under a minute are, first off, that the Sudanese government is a global anomaly. They lack the ability to produce capital and are solely reliant on foreign corporations to come in and provide them both the technology and the capital necessary to drill for oil and provide that to international markets. By targeting these corporations, we're affecting change inside the country by pressuring the government to take action in response to corporations. Doing so, nine corporations, so six in addition to the three that Senator French have already mentioned, have withdrawn or substantially altered their policies inside Sudan, speaking towards the efficacy of the movement. Secondly, in reference to sovereign wealth funds, some of the world's largest and most well-respected sovereign wealth funds have elected to adopt investment policies that reflect their financial and moral obligations and include at times negative screening. The Norwegian Government Pension Fund, the Australian Future Fund, and the New Zealand Superannuation Fund are all in this category. Sovereign wealth funds have a responsibility to preserve their resources for future generations, but they also have a responsibility to preserve a world that presents that to preserve a world and future that is good and provides future beneficiaries a world that they would like to live in. For that reason, I think we can see that the Alaska Permanent Fund's actions would not be out of line of actions taken by other sovereign wealth funds. In addition to that, we can view that this is not a permanent policy. Inside the legislation are four sunset scenarios under which this bill would terminate, both with the conclusion of the genocide in Darfur and possibly an assertion by the President of the United States or Congress that these policies interfere with their ability to make foreign policy. For those reasons, I would say that the committee should vote in favor of the legislation before them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crows, and thanks for your patience. Anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 227? Anyone else online that I've overlooked? Okay, so hearing and seeing none, that does close public testimony for Senate Bill 227, and it brings the bill back before the committee. Is there committee discussion motion?
Madam Chair, I would move that SB 227 be referred from committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
Is there an objection to the motion?
Just for
Senator Stevens.
Comment. I wish I knew more about the Darfur issue. I've read some about it, but I think as a student of history, my knowledge of the Nazi Holocaust is much more intense. I've read a lot more about it. And because of that, I can't help but think that if we had done something in 1941, we could have stopped some of the suffering that occurred there. I'm questioning whether we should be doing this, but I think it's an issue that's well worth discussion, and I'm willing to move it on to finance for that purpose.
And Senator Stevens, I would echo those thoughts. I have questioned the slippery slope concept and how it would play out practically, and I know the Permanent Fund Corporation has concerns about that, and we'll continue to look at the issue, but I too, like you, have just woken up at night on this issue and felt like saying nothing and doing nothing during times of atrocity, much like the Holocaust, in some way makes you responsible. And so I too share your concerns and thoughts that we move it forward and continue the discussion. I appreciate Senator French bringing it forward. Okay, so there's no objection. Is the objection removed, Senator Stevens?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and so Senate Bill 227 has passed, and we are adjourned.